Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, with a fun show. Actually, we had for our inbox question, we had someone just straight up ask us, you have all these counselors like answer inbox questions, and could these counselors actually help me? Yeah, they can. We have a whole counseling department here at Focus, and so we're going to actually talk about what that department does, how you can be in contact with them, what they can do for you, and just what all that means, and really what are some of the types of calls that they get. So we want to hook you up. So we're going to do that at the end of the show. Then for our culture segment, we have Ray Johnston. He's a pastor out of Sactown, Sacramento in California, and author of The Hope Quotient. So this is like everyone knows about IQ and EQ. So hopefully you've done all the necessary assessments.
Is that HQ?
This is HQ. The Hope Quotient, which he argues is probably even more important than both of those. How hopeful are you for your future, for others' futures? How does that play into the decisions that you make today? So in the book, there's like an assessment that you can take, and I took it, and I'm relatively hopeful. I'm just going to be honest. So I think that's a good thing. But I was very, I thought I'd be off the charts hopeful, but I actually had some things that weren't so hopeful. So, well, point of something to work on. Okay.
Just averagely hopeful.
Speaking of being hopeful, for our roundtable, you remember maybe in the past we have talked about kind of those unique situations of if you marry into this or if this is kind of the way your relationship goes based on this. Like vocations and stuff like that. We did a roundtable with people who had military connections, so they were married to someone in the military or they themselves were in the military. What are the unique challenges there? We also did one with physicians. So basically, if you're signing up for that 36-year story of getting them through school, what does that look like? And, you know, is there ever a light at the end of the tunnel? Can you even survive marriage, helping someone through medical school and then being married to someone who's just in a hospital 23 out of 24 hours a day. And here we are, not unlike those who are in ministry. So we're doing that today, a discussion with folks who are either in ministry or married to people in ministry or both. So I want to welcome Kieran, Adam, and Jason to the table. Hey, guys.
Glad to be here.
Very good to have you. So we have Kieran, who is in ministry here at Focus on the Family, part of our marriage team at Focus on the Family. And her hubster is, I will let you describe what he does.
He is an associate pastor for our church.
Okay. Ooh, for the church she actually has to go to. Okay, then we have Adam, who you, whom you all know and love, Adam Holtz from our Plugged In team.
Glad to be here.
He's just like just ministers to everyone.
Well, I do what I can.
And his wife is?
My wife, Jennifer, is the senior associate executive pastor at First Presbyterian downtown here in Colorado Springs. So she just got a big promotion, and it's been an interesting journey. So maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, especially because she has like three titles.
Exactly. It's too many adjectives. The editor in me wants to pare it back, but they didn't ask me.
Yeah. Well, it needs to be the SAE pastor.
Right.
Senior Associate Executive.
Exactly.
Okay. And Jason, give us your deets.
Yeah, I work with the middle school ministry at Woodman Valley Chapel.
Okay.
So working in student ministries, you have a super unpredictable schedule. And my wife actually used to work here at Focus, but now she's at home raising our new little man, Xander, who is 3 months old as of a few days ago. So we're super pumped about that.
Yeah, that's
so you haven't slept in 3 months, right?
The last month, he slept through the night.
That's awesome.
Wow. It's awesome. He's like ahead of the curve on that.
Wow.
That's inspirational.
Just wait till the next one.
I think they're all like that, I'm pretty sure.
My 7-year-old has quit sleeping through the night.
All of yours will be, for sure. So. Yes. All of you has quit sleeping through the night. Nice. Okay. And I will, because we are an audio podcast, I do have to draw attention to Jason's attire, which is very youth pastor appropriate. He has goldenrod jeans on, no joke. Like kind of a mustardy.
They are. And they're like they're skinny jeans and they're distressed too. So I really covered all my bases.
You did.
Skinny,
and you've
distressed.
You've
golden
got flip-flops on with a coordinating watch.
I do.
And the puka shell jewelry, or whatever that is, that's kind of like...
I don't even know what you just said, but that means I'm old, I guess.
You know, it's like that surfer-esque kind of look. So.
Okay.
Anyway, Very good. So let's go ahead and jump into this conversation. I won't draw to anyone's attention.
My pants are brown, if anybody's wondering.
Adam's are brown. He's got a button-down shirt
on. Not golden brown, just brown.
Well, Karen's coordinating. She has the mustard-colored scarf.
Me too. So she's and brown pants.
Working.
Oh, nice. She's got some kind
drawing
of
from both worlds. Yeah. All right, so let's talk through this here. I want to know, when we talk about ministry, as you look at the grand scheme of career and where you came from, was ministry and I say that generally, so whatever y'all have done, and some of you have even walked a couple different roads in that scene, was it your first choice? Was this something that you were like, this is what I'm going to do with my life, or did you kind of fall into it? How did your entree into the world of Jesus freaks come about?
Well, I know for me, when I got saved and I was 18, I kind of made the decision that student ministry is the only thing I wanted to do. Huh. So,
did you get saved through student ministry?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Big deal.
Oh, yeah. It was a huge deal to me. So, yeah, I just kind of made the decision. Well, I had no idea what it looked like to go into ministry. I still had plans to go to the college. I was, kind of signed on in scholarship, too. I just thought you kind of did ministry when you were done, no matter what your degree was, and I had a little help. Getting kind of redirected the right way.
Which is so interesting you say that, because when I went to camp as a kid, I thought for sure I was going to be a lifetime camp counselor. Because I'm like, I can tell these kids what to do, and I can be in the woods, and that's awesome. So I don't even know why I didn't follow that path.
Now you do it behind a microphone, which is kind of the same thing.
I do.
Thing,
I'm able
different.
To tell people what to do. I do live in the mountains. I occasionally go to the woods. So I try to get the best of all worlds. But nice. How about you, Adam?
Boy, it's a complicated question. I'm trying to figure out how to shorten it. I didn't get saved, but I really began to get serious with my walk with Christ when I was in college, and that was through the Navigators. And I ended up working in several different positions with the Navigators for about 10 years, both more ministry-oriented and writing and editing-oriented. So some different sort of, I guess, iterations of what that looks like. And I've been at Focus about 10 years now as well, mostly working on the writing and editing side of things. But for a good chunk of both of those jobs, I was also heavily involved in ministry to single adults at my church. Mm-hmm. And then my wife was doing the same thing, and that's kind of how we met.
Okay.
So that's the really condensed version.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
I never planned on being in ministry, but thinking about it, I've always fallen into it in some way, shape, or form. I was always involved in youth group. I went to a one-year Bible college after high school, and then I ended up getting a double major at a Bible college. Hmm. And now I work at a ministry. So I've never set forth my path to be this, but... Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to tell you how you got into it? Because I know.
Tell me.
You moved to Colorado Springs.
Yeah.
I did.
So basically, because you were working...
It's a de facto choice to be involved in.
I mean, you were you were in a mortgage company?
I was at a financial planning firm, Northwestern Mutual.
Yeah, so then basically you move here and you start building friendships with people that work at all these ministries, because there are literally 180 here in Colorado Springs. It's the Christian Mecca.
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird because you start building these connections and all of a sudden you're like, well, here's this job opening at Navigators, Compassion, Focus on the Family, Every Home for Christ. I mean, they all exist here.
My husband actually helped me get my job here at Focus.
Yeah,
so I blame him.
That's the way to do it. So, I think for me too, I had moved, I'd been in the corporate world and all that, and I had no real, I remember watching the Focus film series as a kid when it came to our church and the big reels of film.
What's film?
Yeah, I know. Well, we'll talk about it later.
Right.
And then when I moved to Colorado Springs, which I just moved without a job, Focus was one of the options. And so I was like, oh, I'll apply for a job there. Didn't really know what it was about except for Dr. Dobson. And then I think even now, it's funny how after you've worked at a ministry for a while, it's kind of like being a CPA and you work in that world and you do your networking and you build connections, and it's kind of like the ministry to ministry transition seems to be kind of easier or similar to that. You know, everyone kind of knows what you're talking about when you mention different ministries and I know so and so and they work there and whatever. Now let's talk a little bit about I mean, you can weave in kind of how you specifically got into this as part of your answer, but any kind of what have been your big aha moments, both for good and or struggles or disillusionment as you found yourself kind of planting yourself in this world? Because I think, for example, I'm just going to say, I know a friend who went into a ministry position back in the day from the corporate world, and I think she had, you know, a little vision of, oh, the corporate world was so difficult, and mm-hmm. so ministry is going to be awesome. It's going to be a restful yeah. place. It's going to be, and then all of a sudden, all these coworkers started coming in who had like bona fide issues, who thought that by working at a ministry, they were going to be solved. So they kind of came as their own personal counseling yeah. network to, if I can just join this ministry and have people pray for me, yeah. my entire life of dysfunction is going to be taken away from me. So what have been, like, for good or for bad, what have you learned?
Well, I think building on that, especially I think if you're on the younger side of things, it's easy to have sort of rose-colored glasses with regard to ministry of any kind, whether we're talking being a staff person on a church, being involved in a parachurch ministry like Focus or the Navigators or some of the other ones we've talked about. I think that hopefully if you're involved in ministry, the other people there want to do ministry too. So in some ways, I think it is, you know, really, really different fundamentally. And yet we're all still broken humanoids at some level. You know, some people are flat out dysfunctional, as you just talked about. But they're, you know, in any organization, there's bureaucracy, there's things that don't make sense. There's people who are above you who make decisions you may not understand or agree with. And I think the bigger the organization that it is, the more likely that is to be true. And so I think even though it doesn't sound very spiritual, there's always going to be organizational politics, if I can use that word. There's just stuff that you're going to have to deal with that you're like, man, I just want to minister to people and I'm dealing with this mess that doesn't seem to have anything to do with that.
Right. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people go into ministry thinking that I'm not going to have to worry about budgets or accountability or structure or anything.
Well, you're certainly going to have to worry about budgets.
Yeah. I'm just going to be ministering, you know, and then you realize, oh, I'm actually required to write a business plan. I'm required to hit certain goals. Right. And yeah, it can be disillusioning.
I think if we can keep from compartmentalizing our spirituality and our ministry, that helps your perspective tremendously. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we can't walk into a ministry or a church assuming everybody's high functioning and emotionally intelligent, you know, because like you said, we're all broken.
Yeah.
But if you consider ministry to be an outflow or an outpouring of your work every day in terms of how you treat people, how you go about doing your work, that's where the ministry happens, regardless if it's Focus or if it's a financial planning firm.
Yeah, I know, like, in vocational ministry, one of my big shell shocks when I moved here about 4 years ago to work at Woodman was just, you know, kind of like what Adam was saying, like, the bureaucracy and, like, all the different kind of steps and different addendums to, you know, wanting to launch an event or do something. And that was just, that was really challenging for me because I came from a real freewheeling environment in Chicago for 7 years where we just had an awesome time running this youth church.
It was just all lock-ins and dodgeball.
Yeah, it was so rad. We loved it.
It was so rad. Nice.
But that, you know, so every now and again, since I got here, I kind of had to be really intentional and check myself to be like, okay, am I just kind of, am I part of an organization or am I still dreaming enough to think that I'm part of a movement I'm doing something really important in? You know, it sounds really like tech savvy, but I have like a reminder on my phone to stop and pause once a month. And and that's been wildly helpful because, yeah, I get disillusioned really quickly because I'm really, I love vision and dreaming and new things and change and church just obviously changes like really slowly.
Yeah, and unless you're involved in something really small that's kind of got a startup vibe to it, every ministry has a certain amount of infrastructure.
Right.
You know, you and it doesn't seem, again, very romantic or idealistic, but, you know, somebody has to pay to have air conditioning in the building. And, you know, you got to have, you know, we've been, especially in the last 5 or 6 years, you know, security issues. And so people will want to have some sort of event. And the question is, okay, well, who's going to do security? Is there going to be somebody there? You know, if you're going to have a youth event and go to midnight, is there a security person staying till midnight? And it doesn't seem, it's like, well, who cares? Well,
right.
you know, if something bad happens, you will care. And these are right. the yeah. really sort of, you know, nitty gritty realities of ministry that don't seem to have much to do with ministry, but that are still pretty important and yeah. have to grapple with them.
Yeah. Well, or even the era of, especially with larger churches, I'm sure both yeah. First Press and Woodman have this, like background checks exactly. and all that. I mean, when I worked in nursery, it was like, do you have the time and can you just come in here and hold one of these kids?
Yeah. Exactly.
No one right. even cared who I was back in high school and yeah. stuff yep. like that. And now right. it's a big deal and necessary.
Yeah.
All right, let's talk a little bit about others' reactions to the positions you have or your marriage or how this plays out. Because I know for me, I get one of two reactions. It tends to be I'm put on a pedestal of like, oh, your whole life is ministry and all you get to do all day is impact people. And that's so amazing. Or
it's a hint of sarcasm in your voice.
A little bit of sarcasm, yeah. Or kind of the idea of, well, you don't even have a real job. Like some of us are out here doing the real jobs and then you're just there being like, having this cushy, like, whatever. Like, let's be honest, my own sisters a couple times are like, well, those of us who aren't in ministry, we actually have, you know, or we don't have all this time to do XYZ or whatever. So what do you guys hear?
Yeah, I hear the real job thing all the time, being in youth ministry.
Yeah.
Like, they just assume that you kind of, like,
play all day.
Yeah, you play all day.
Play dodgeball.
Yeah,
all the
we're
time.
Playing pool and foosball while the kids are in school, and then we're picking them up and running around and doing stuff. But it's shocking when I tell people how long I'm actually in front of a computer and planning and prepping and researching and doing things and you know the bureaucracies of a large church. But I get it.
Staff meetings.
Oh yeah,
you have to do that. Yeah. Okay.
Go ahead, Adam.
Okay. Well, I'm in the perhaps less frequent position of being a spouse of one of the ministers at our large church. And so, I mean, my official title at church is Jennifer's husband, you know, which is great. I mean, frankly, I'm totally secure in that. My wife and I were talking the other night that I have all sorts of insecurities, but that's not one of them. So I love being in that role at church, and we do a lot of ministry together. So, I mean, we really think of each other as a team. But, you know, I'm sure that there are people who might look at me and think, that's kind of weird. What's their deal? How's that work? And it works because we both really have a passion for ministry and a deep desire to love people at church. And I think this is I'm taking a tangent here, but I think that if you have a desire to really love people and minister, if you're in it for the right reasons, these sorts of issues kind of take care of themselves. And it doesn't mean that they're not frustrating sometimes.
Sure,
but and I think that's what we come back to amid things that are hard is we love ministering to people.
Now, do you find yourself having to defend your wife, especially outside the church, who are like, why is your wife a pastor?
You know, occasionally. Those conversations come up sometimes, but I think she's been there somewhere in the neighborhood of 13 years now. So we don't have those kind of conversations at church very often. And sometimes, you know, somebody will ask me about that or have a different thought on that. And certainly I'm willing to have that conversation.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I think when we tell people my husband's a pastor and I work at a nonprofit ministry, I guess they're the same thing, nonprofit and ministry. But I think they often box us in and stereotype we're probably ultra conservative or probably very Republican. There's nothing wrong with being Republican. And we probably have chickens and homeschool our children, you know? So I think we get boxed in and are stereotyped quite frequently, or they assume we have it all together. You know, and we don't deal with real life issues because we're not in real life.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's an issue. I mean, even with something like, if our kids are acting out at church, you know, my wife doesn't like me yelling at the children in public because it looks bad, right? And I'm like, it is what it is. You know, we're trying to work it out.
We yell at our kids too.
And we're not perfect and we don't have it all together. And I think even if you're not trying to cultivate that kind of an image, and some people I think do cultivate it. I think our generation maybe less so. It's like, you know, we're just trying to figure it out too. So.
Okay. Well, as we kind of wrap up here, let's talk about this last thing that interests me, and that is the push or the pressure for trajectory or success, specifically when it comes to money or to where you're going to be. I mean, I think people can get stressed about 401ks. They can get stressed about, if I give my entire life to a ministry, where am I going to be when I'm 65? And what's that, you know, what do you feel is the pressure for those who maybe, you know, you have friends that are probably in jobs where they are completely escalating along some kind of career thing, large corporations, there's a lot of room for growth. And you may just be like, this is the only place I have to go unless I, God calls me somewhere else. How have you wrestled with that and with providing for a family and or just being in the midst of what your own dreams are and reconciling those with where you are?
You know, I think that a decision to be in ministry, unless you're really screwed up, most people don't take a ministry path because they want to make lots of money. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you are trusting God, and this is going to sound super cliched, but I think it's true, you know, you trust that he's going to give you meaningful work to do that is going to meet your needs. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I were both on staff. She was on staff with InterVarsity. I was on staff with the Navigators. You know, we both had to raise support. Mm. If you've ever raised support for a living, it's wonderful and crazy all at the same time. but it's just part of the deal. And you accepted that. Okay, if I want to go work for this organization, this is how it works. So I think there is a probably a baseline acceptance that you're not going to be rich, but hopefully, you know, you'll get your needs met because that's what scripture tells us.
Yeah, there's something like understood about when you, when you're going into ministry. Like, I don't think, you know, Becca would have ever married me if she kind of wasn't fully into ministry, because this is such a unique vocational choice, especially working with student ministries. And, you know, for me, like I have, you know, I'm almost 35 and I have no desire to do anything beyond student ministry. Like, I just love students and just believe them so much. And,
So you're not on that stepping stone path to senior pastor like some of those youth guys are?
Yeah, definitely not. Like, for me, like, gosh, that's a step backwards. Like, you're preaching to people that have already kind of determined, but we're working with people that are still forming and deciding who they are and understanding their character and stuff. So I think that's like the highest calling in ministry. You know, I'm like the only person in our church that thinks that, but that's okay. But yeah, I think there's something understood. Like, when you go in to get married, like, if you don't have someone that's fully on board with ministry and you marry that person, like, man, you're just asking for all sorts of issues later in life, especially when it comes to where your time goes, because your time's not really static, it's very fluid.
Right.
Yeah. And, like, money, because, I mean, I'm a millionaire being a youth pastor, but most people, that's just...
Well, and point being, I mean, many of you will remember, Becca has actually been on our show. Her dad is an orthopedic surgeon, so it's like, she transferred her allegiance to Mr. Youth Minister.
This is a lifestyle
shift. Better be in it. Yeah, she better be in it to win it.
And I think our dreams for those in ministry or who are pastors, the dream isn't the house or the yard or the vacations. It's the meaning in life. And it's, like you said, Lisa, it's what's meaningful. And that's working with people and loving people. And that's what makes you the millionaire, Jason. You know?
Good point.
It's having that
with
impact.
The goldenrod pants.
Exactly. Right. I wanted to look like a trophy today.
That's, that's good. Yeah, in the wake of the Emmys.
Good. Oh, okay. That's right.
Very cool. All right. Well, great thoughts, you guys. I think that is is meaningful and brings up some great points. And also, I mean, just as we close, I want to assure you all, because I know I have a lot of friends that, you know, work. They're the teachers. They're the accountants. They're the corporate, you know, folks. And your jobs are not ministry, you know? So, and I think it's easy to lose sight of that, but I like what you said, Karen, of just, we have to look holistically at this. If we don't have our ministry life and then we go and do normal things. I mean, it's just, where is God using us? What place are we in right now? So it's a good thing to keep in mind. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Here in this moment, we find a mercy that's our fears we surrender, for all our hope is found in you. On your word we stand, your faithful to the end. We believe our God is on
Well, folks, we are here for this week's culture interview, culture segment here on The Boundless Show. And we've got a new friend to The Boundless Show here. I have Ray Johnston. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you. It's nice to be here, Lisa.
Very good to have you. Ray is actually the founding pastor of Bayside Church out in Sacramento, California, which is one of the largest churches in the nation, and the founder of Thriving Churches International and Thrive Communications, and has done a lot of youth and adult ministry, I understand, in churches, as well as being on the board for Azusa Pacific. So you know kind of the college young adult demographic pretty well.
I'm the only guy I know that was a senior pastor, resigned that job, and became a youth pastor.
Really?
Yeah, it was a great promotion.
So I was going to say, so you did get promoted. That's good to know. Good to know. So, well, you, in addition to all this stuff, just in your free time, apparently, have been studying something that you call the Hope Quotient.
Yep.
And you wrote a book about it, the Hope Quotient, HQ, Measure It, Raise It, You'll Never Be the Same. And we thought this would be kind of fun to discuss for our audience because, you know, in this transitionary time of life for a lot of young adults, they feel like either they're in a situation that's hopeless or they can't change their own circumstances, or they don't really know, have a vision for where they could go from here. So this is going to be a fun discussion. Now, I went, for those who do get the book, The Hope Quotient, there's actually an assessment that you can do, and I went ahead and did it.
Oh, you took it. Good.
I did. I took it. My score was 102.5.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty hopeful,
mm-hmm.
right? That's pretty good. So I thought that was good.
102.5 sounds like a radio station.
It does. It does. So that's why I wanted to kind of skew my score a little bit. saying that my strongest predictors of hope were factors 2 and 4, and I have to work on 5. And as Ray and I talk, you guys will understand what that means, because you have, what is it, 7 predictors?
Yeah. You know, when I wrote this book, it took 7 years to write. I mean,
whoa.
I was a professor in Chicago, and so I like doing some research stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I started reading this, and anybody young will kind of get this.
Yeah.
There's so much trite stuff out there.
Yeah.
And so what happened is we started studying hope, and what led into that was a conversation I had with my daughter, Leslie, mm-hmm. who's 23, she'll be 23 in a week. Leslie came home and she said, "Hey, Dad, I have to write a paper on a leader, and I picked you, and they said it was okay." And she goes, "I got 20 questions. You got to answer them all honestly." We talked for 2 hours. Her last question—
In the hot tub.
Yeah, in the hot tub. Very good. So, yeah, I thought, I'm going to end up in hot water. May as well start there. Her last question, she said, "What's the most important thing you do as a leader?" And anybody that's tuned into this, I'd say, boy, as a student, as a 20 or 30 year old, as a married, what's the most important thing you do? I looked at her and said, "That's easy." Mm-hmm. And I said, "And if anybody thinks about it deeply enough, they'll come to the same conclusion. The most important thing I do is make sure I stay encouraged."
Hmm.
Because if I'm not encouraged, I looked at her and I said, "If I'm not encouraged, I'll never be that leader, communicator, pastor that God wants me to be." Hmm. I got emotional. I said, "Honey, if I'm not encouraged, I will never be the dad you need me to be." And I said, "And I'll never be the husband mom dreams up I might be someday."
Yeah.
And what I realized is discouragement actually precedes destruction.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find anything that was ever destroyed where discouragement didn't create the quicksand that took, for example, I've never met anybody that said, "You know, I'm so encouraged about my marriage, I'm getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. I'm so encouraged about how my career's going, I'm quitting. I'm mm-hmm. so encouraged about school, I'm dropping out." Discouragement arrives first, and then things get destroyed. And so I wanted to write a book that would help people basically go, what do you do when you're discouraged? How do you combat it? And what happened is we went, it's the only book on hope ever written that's not about hope. It's about the 7 things that if you build them into the life, you'll have hope. And if you don't build them into your life, you're going to be in real trouble. And so is your future.
Okay. So you actually say in the book that hope is something that we actually have control over. It's something that we definitely can control and manage. But I mean, if I were to think about it, I mean, I would think, and you gotta debunk this myth if it's incorrect, aren't some people naturally more hopeful than others, or they're wired that way, or no?
Some people are naturally more buoyant than other people. But what I would say on this, I autographed a book for a guy the other day. His 20-year-old came up and said, "Would you sign this?"
Mm-hmm.
So I signed the book, and he said, "I want to thank you for writing that. I'm about halfway through reading it." And I said, "I did not write this book for you to read it. I wrote this book so that you could go over and over again and you would have a tool. So the minute something goes wrong in your life, you can take a look and go, which one of these seven things is out of line and how do I get this thing back? Because the problem is this, people are growing up with an education. Nobody's teaching them how to live. Mm-hmm. These seven things, they never get talked about in school.
Yeah. Okay. And we're going to dive into those. But the first thing I want to ask you is, what squelches hope? Why are we in a culture where people are so discouraged, so defeated? It's a wonder that any of us are even making it from day to day from some of the stuff we see. And of course, we just saw the reports of Robin Williams.
Tragic.
Yeah. And so I think this is a very timely conversation. So why do we despair, or at the very least doubt what's bogging us down? Is this a unique point in history for this, or help us figure that out?
There may be some factors.
I'm getting discouraged just talking about it.
No kidding. Okay. Hey, let's close in prayer.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually believe what drives people down into discouragement is doing the opposite of these seven things. Okay. I mean, when somebody goes, for example, mm-hmm. Chapter 7 is play great defense. Mm-hmm. There are some things that are so toxic. If I let them into my life and I don't fight them off, sure. I will, the minute resentment and bitterness enter my life, hope exits mm-hmm. every time. I also think, though, we're living in a pretty challenge. For example, you watch TV or you go to a movie, every guy's a total stud and every woman's gorgeous. Then you go look in a mirror. Mm-hmm. So Hollywood sets us up, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. Success sets us. Some people have been set up by their parents. I mean, mm-hmm. they're either perfectionists or their home's so shattered they don't think they have a future. We have a definition of discouragement we use at Bayside. We say discouragement is the anesthetic that the devil uses on a person just before he reaches in and carves out their heart. Hmm. And so it may have a number of causes, but when it arrives, everybody's going to get discouraged.
Yeah.
When people stay down, though, that can be fatal.
Yeah.
And that's what we discovered with Robin Williams.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think one of the ones, I want to talk through a couple of these. I think the first one you mentioned is the idea of rest and being able to recharge.
Yep.
What is the difference, though, between a truly restful recharging and this idea of just checking out? Like people that are just like watching TV but not really watching it, kind of. I mean, there has to be a biblical idea of rest here that really is an energizing source that's not just...
yeah.
Because I think a lot of us, we just think that, I'm resting because all I'm doing is doing 3 hours on Facebook, but that's truly not restful.
Yeah, Lisa, it's interesting. We have 8 services every weekend at Bayside. I preach 6 of them live.
Wow.
And so my weekends are pretty intense. Mm-hmm. And what I discovered a couple years ago is a lot of time discouragement masks itself as burnout. Hmm. So somebody will come to me and say, I'm burned out, which automatically means I'm too busy. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, there have been seasons in my life where I'm really busy and I'm doing fine, and other seasons where I'm less busy and I feel burned out. Hmm. So a lot of times the root cause isn't necessarily I'm too busy. It's that I'm burned out. Like on this one, I think when somebody goes, okay, I've got to, the chapters basically replace burnout with balance. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. There are just some things I've got to build into my life. And what happens, somebody needs to study themselves. Like if you and I had a conversation about you, I would go, what drains you and what recharges you? Because until somebody figures that out, whatever is draining you, do less of it. And whatever recharges you, and it's different for every, some people are recharged by being with people. Mm-hmm. Other people are recharged by getting alone. But somebody's got to figure out what recharges my batteries, what helps me bounce back, and then what drains me.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. One of the other things that you talk about, and this was certainly reflected in the test that I did, is this idea of being able to be a future thinker and not dwelling on. Yeah. I mean, when you're knocked down or when you experience defeat or discouragement, the fact that you can say, okay, that was then, but I'm hopeful for the future. Things will change. Something good is going to come of this. How can we actually be future thinking? Especially this generation that, maybe is wondering, maybe they're stuck in a job right now that they're like, am I ever going to get out of this job? Can I ever find something? You know, they look at, and I talk about this a lot on Boundless, we have access to so many outliers, all these Christian superstars that are either doing amazing things in Africa, or they're awesome pastors, or they're on the stage at Catalyst or whatever. And how can a person envision a good future for themselves?
Yeah, you know, but first, let me take the second comment first.
Yeah.
Like, there's all these superstars.
Yeah.
I know a lot of these people.
Mm-hmm.
They're just as screwed up as any of us. I mean,
they need this book too, probably.
Oh, man. Yeah. A buddy of mine picked up this guy at the airport, and this guy at the airport was screaming and yelling at somebody carrying his bags. And then my buddy picks him up, turns around, and goes, "Hey, praise the Lord." And off he went to speak on the love of God at this thing. So there's a lot of that. We do a Thrive conference every year. And so a lot of these folks come in. And one of the things we say at the Thrive Conference is this: don't be intimidated by anybody, okay? Because you hear somebody's story and you're going, well, God did one great thing out of 30 years. Maybe you can do that for me.
Sure.
Your original question was?
Oh, just the idea of what does it mean to be future thinking?
Yes.
Yeah.
Number one, it's massive. Discouraged people almost have this in common. They're looking backwards or they're looking around.
Mm-hmm.
There's a word in the Bible that most people have never paid attention to, and Jesus used it. And it is one of the most powerful words in the Bible. It's just nobody knows it. Jesus said to the disciples, and they were a mess, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He said to the disciples, "Follow me and I will make you become fishes of men." That's a huge, that word become is a huge word.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I've discovered is this: if somebody is focused on what they are like right now, or what their marriage is like right now, or what their finances are like right now, they'll probably be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody can stay focused like Jesus did on what they can become, it opens up the whole brand new future.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm working with people, especially people in their 20s and 30s, most people in their 20s and 30s, and we do a lot of mentoring retreats with them, are going, what am I going to do for the rest of my life?
Sure.
I basically go, the first thing you got to do is you got to get this word become down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then I go, let me give you three questions. Get a journal out. Question number one is, what are your unique factors? What's God made you better at than 99%? What are your spiritual gifts? Interview people. What are you great at? What are you unique? Second question they ask, I have a journal on this, is what are you passionate about?
Hmm.
Like 20,000 years after you've been in heaven, what are you going to be glad you made happen?
Mm-hmm.
What fulfills you?
Mm-hmm.
And figure that out. Most people never answer that question until it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And then question number three is, when are you happy?
Yeah.
And you journal on those things. And when those three things come together, all of a sudden doors open to somebody's future. But they're into a future that they've thought about instead of, well, I just got that job.
Okay. So I know there are a lot of pastors and authors out there, Ray, who talk about the value of, failing well. So this idea, failing forward and all this kind of stuff. What is the difference? I mean, I know you talk here about making mistakes. What's the difference between learning from your mistakes and letting them define you? Because I think people can get stuck on mistakes, saying I'm a failure. I can never do that again. I won't even touch that because I failed at it once. How can you move past mistake making in that sense?
You know what I do? I would read and reread and reread chapter 4, Play to Your Strengths.
Mm-hmm.
Because if somebody really gets a grip on the fact that God has gifted me, I may have no clue what that is.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I led worship. When I was a youth pastor, I thought, everybody's got to lead worship. I'm going to lead worship. I led worship one time,
mm-hmm.
and I have never led worship again.
Mm-hmm.
I got up to lead.
Was that bad?
Oh, it was Sunday night service, low risk, 80 people there. They're like, let's let Ray give it a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So I get up. Well, somebody projected one song.
Mm-hmm.
I'm leading a different song, and the piano's playing another song. It broke after half that song. Then we tried a second song, same thing happened. Third song. By the end of the third song, people are laughing so hard. I walked off. And now, was I discouraged? No. I thought, okay, that's just another thing God's not gifted me. I actually took my guitar, gave it to somebody who could lead worship, and I've never led worship again to the glory of God. And what's interesting is, if I were basing my self-image on, I have to succeed at everything,
mm-hmm.
I'd have been destroyed. A good theology of spiritual gifts, I'm going, well, I guess that's not my spiritual gift. I'll keep looking,
mm-hmm.
Is a very healthy thing.
Hmm.
And I think for folks to come to grips, God made you, God gifted you, and with those two things, and then you discover what they are. And if you fail at something, you're going, oh, okay, I may have learned some things, but it might just be that's not, God obviously did not want me leading worship.
Yeah, okay. So for you, when you look at the hope quotient, when you apply this to your own life, what has been your biggest takeaway in what do you have to keep coming back to cultivate this for yourself?
I'd say of right, for me, it's all seven at some point, but right now it's factor number two, raise your expectations.
Okay.
I was blown away. I read Steve Jobs, the biography written on him, and it, first half was Steve being a jerk. Second half of it was still Steve being a jerk, but he was an amazing leader. And what I realized is Steve Jobs believed impossible things were possible.
Okay.
We're going to build a computer in a box. Everybody said it's impossible.
Yeah.
We're going to do this. We're going to make an iPhone with glass that doesn't even exist yet. And matter of fact, engineers said to him one time, you can't change the laws of physics. And Steve said, watch me. And when I was done reading that book, it dawned on me. I went, you know what's interesting is? The secular world now believes impossible things are possible. At the very same time, Christians have stopped believing that. We can't do that. It's not in the budget, that sort of thing. And so for me, that whole thing about raise your expectations, that's been very convicting because, and now, like for the last year and a half, every time I'm discouraged, I look in a mirror and I say, Ray, you're probably discouraged because you're focused only on problems and you're expecting only defeat. Focus on more than the problem. Focus on God instead of, don't deny those problems exist, but focus on God and expect God's going to show up and help you. And that tends to help pull me out of discouragement.
Yeah.
But I, you know, it's, and it's, I probably say that to myself four times a week. I'll look in a mirror and go, you know better than this. Quit focusing only on your problems and quit expecting only defeat. That has been a game changer for me.
Yeah. Well, I think too, I think it would be helpful if in light of this, as soon as you were talking about Steve Jobs, Christians need to stop basically just talking about stuff and making committees about them and then copying what the world is already doing.
No kidding.
I mean... That's just, that seems to be what we're good at, is like talking about all the things we should do. And I remember hearing specifically, I think it was Steve Jobs and or Bill Gates, where they talked about how there are many people with great ideas, but it's the guys who are willing to sit in their garages and start actually enacting them. That's what, those are the people, the very few, the small percentage of people that actually start making things happen.
Lisa, that's brilliant. But, And people younger get this. I think there's a new American idol out there, and it's a Christian idol. It's not sex, drugs, rock and roll. I think there's a new American idol, and it's safety. Safety first. I mean, you think about it. We're the most seat-belted, airbag, sunscreen-slathering, peanut-avoiding, password-protected, inoculated generation in history. And all it's done is make everybody more afraid of everything. And Christians don't share their faith because that might not be safe. Most Christians don't tithe because that might not be safe. Most Christians don't. And I think what happens is this. Jesus said, hey, I can't find one verse in the Bible that says play it safe. It's like, get out of the boat. And the problem is this, playing it safe shrinks our lives, shrinks our hearts, shrinks God's, and shrinks our impact, and leaves us with shriveled up churches that are basically a group of people gathering that are mild-mannered, and they're going to gather and be more mild-mannered. Number one, it drives me crazy. And I actually believe it drives Jesus crazy.
Yeah. So tell us, give us an example as we close out here. How has this transformed your church? How are you applying this to the community that you're in and the people's lives that you're in? And what are you seeing as a result?
Two quick examples. One is this. A few years ago, I was reading Acts. And what I realized in the book of Acts, their good deeds, it says... Their good deeds led to goodwill. They had favor with God and all the people. The American church said their good deeds created goodwill, which created openness to the good news. I realized 7 years ago, our church, like almost every other American church, we're trying to deliver the good news without good deeds, and there's no goodwill. And I called our staff together, and I said, we have gotten this wrong. We're going to get this. We're going to quit being an American church, and we're going to be a New Testament church. And so we do things like this. The weekend after Mother's Day, we shut our church down for the weekend. We literally get up. All services canceled. We interview every mayor, every principal, and everybody that works with the poor. And we came up last year, we had about a month and a half ago, we had 166 projects and unleashed 10,000 people to serve our community.
Wow.
And we do that every year. Our church has started to become known as the church that cares about the community. Same thing. And by the way, this Planet Safe thing, we had just raised $2 million, which meant I talked about money a lot in our church. Nobody loves that. And I get a call from a guy in Cambodia, and this guy calls, and we have a ministry there. We built houses that rescue girls. Well, this guy calls and says, hey, a weird thing just happened. The general over all sex trafficking for the country just called, and he said, I want to meet with you, that we met. And he said, the cops here are so corrupt, 10 years, there's been no arrests. Every time they do a raid, the pimps are gone, the girls are already gone. He said, I want to form an independent SWAT team, train them, but it's going to cost $250,000, and we don't have that in Cambodia. Is there anywhere you can think of we get this? So this guy says, this crazy church in Northern California called Bayside, let's give him a shot. He calls me, and I turned him down. Can you believe that? I said, you know what? And it was the Planet Safe thing. I said, I just raised a bunch of money. If I talk about money, our church is going to throw me out. And I turned him down. Well, 2 days, God's all over me on this one. So I gathered our staff, and I told him about the conversation, and our staff said, what moron would say no to this? And I'd be like, that'd be me. So I called the guy back and I said, hey, send me a list of, send me a business plan, send me a list of what the money's going to. I've never gotten a list like this in my life. I'm, you know, usually people are saying, Pastor, we need Bibles and basketballs. I'm going, it is like 25 bulletproof vests, surveillance cameras, buttonhole cameras, ammunition, bullets for Jesus, you know, this stuff. And so I stand up in front of our church and I tell our church this. We took second offerings at Christmas Eve, and we need $250,000 by the end of Christmas Eve. Well, our people actually didn't give $250,000. They gave $400,000.
Wow.
We didn't keep a dime of it. And right now, for the last 6 months, this SWAT team has arrested scores and scores of really bad guys and has liberated hundreds of girls, and it's just beginning. And right now in Cambodia, there are a sea of girls that have been rescued, and there are a bunch of bad guys that are now in prison where they can never hurt girls again. And we almost missed the whole thing. That almost didn't happen for one reason. Afraid and thinking about playing it safe.
Yeah. Great example. Wow, Ray, we barely even scratched the surface here. I've been talking with Ray Johnston, again, pastor of Bayside Church in Sacramento and author of The Hope Quotient, which we will link to on our site. Just one last question, though. Bayside Church, what's that about in Sacramento? Like, what bay are you on? Is this a branding issue?
Oh, we're in Granite Bay, California.
Oh, okay. So,
and gotcha. It was interesting. Okay. When there were two copycat suicides of teenagers, and we decided to start a church. And we but we wanted to start a church for people that didn't like church. We almost named it Baywatch. We named it Bayside. That was probably a smart move.
Probably smart, although you probably would have attracted a lot of people thinking people came in swimsuits.
No kidding. Well, we probably do have some people coming in swimsuits.
That's probably true. Thank you so much, Ray, for unpacking this for us. Amazing.
Hey,
amazing.
Lisa, thanks for having us.
Nothing's ever made.
We are here wrapping up the show with this week's Inbox, and I have Dr. Jared Pingleton from our counseling department here at Focus on the Family. Appropriate for you to be addressing this question because it is about our counseling department. So very glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yay. Well, obviously, this is good news because people actually like listen to our show and pay attention to what we're talking about. Because this listener says, I was reading one of the blogs on Boundless, and in one of the answers, the author advised the reader to contact your counseling department. I'm wondering if you can please provide me with the information for that department, as I would like to get set up with a Christian counselor. Is this free of charge? And I think this is a great question because it gives us a chance to not just answer the particulars, but really showcase what it is that you guys do on your average day, which, you know, some of us are just like, do you guys really work? I mean, honestly, what are you doing, Dr. Jared? So, no, but go ahead and give a little window into what this department does for Focus on the Family.
Oh, I'll be glad to, Lisa. Great question. And we would be thrilled to accommodate this listener and help them with their goal of growing and healing. What we do is very unique in our department. We deal with about 150 to 200 hurting people per day and work with them on their relationship issues, their individual issues, spiritual issues. We have a team of 15 licensed clinicians and pastoral chaplains that can address their questions, concerns, and issues. And so what we do, Lisa, is we offer folks a consultation that is free of charge on the telephone or by email, typically on the phone. We prefer that. It's more personal and direct and interactive and warm. And we offer them help in terms of their need. And many times we'll offer them resources, books, CDs, broadcasts, other kinds of web articles or other things on our website that can be of help to them. And many times we will make an additional assist by giving them a referral. And what we have, Lisa, is a nationwide network of about 1,900 licensed Christian mental health clinicians, counselors, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, marriage and family therapists, nationwide. And what we have is a locator service on our website that is a tool that by geographic region, by specialty, by you know, gender, whatever the particulars are of what kind of a clinician or therapist they're looking for, we can hook them up with in a way that is very personal, effective, and efficient. One thing that we want to understand is that we want to be seen as a compassionate, trusted guide in our department, as Focus is generally, to where we can, with a high degree of assurance, make this recommendation. And the reason we can do that, Lisa, is our department has personally vetted or approved both Christianly and clinically each of these 1,900 people on our network.
Okay, awesome. Can you give us, just briefly here, a few examples of when you get calls from, say, Christian single young adults, what are the types of questions that you're hearing? What are the types of things you could help our audience with?
Pretty much anything. Many times, Christians are struggling with personal issues they don't feel safe to really talk about. And I think particularly singles feel that much more acutely. There's a sense of loneliness or detachment. And when they have relationship questions, when they have identity questions, when they have sexuality questions, when they have spiritual questions, many times they don't feel connected well with a pastor, with a clinician, with a family member that's emotionally safe to be able to address those questions. And so we're available to deal with all of those.
Good. Okay. Yeah, I know even some in our audience have mentioned that they've called in and have, you know, your team addresses everything from you know, same-sex attraction, to addictions, to relationships with your parents. I mean, there are just a lot of things. I think some in our audience maybe wouldn't even think of the varied resources.
Oh, absolutely.
Provide,
so. There's really nothing we don't address. I mean, to very difficult and unusual and personal things, to garden variety kinds of things that still often are, when they're ours, they're meaningful. And when we're hurting, it's painful.
Okay. And give us how then, if someone's saying, I really do need to do this initial consultation, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Sure. 800-A-FAMILY.
Okay.
And what will happen is you will have your phone call answered by a family help specialist in our relationship services department. And then when you express to one of those people that you would like to have a counseling consultation, they will take your name and number and topic areas so that we can funnel your call to the person that's best qualified on our team. Mm-hmm. And generally, we are able to call that person back in 24 to 48 hours.
Wow. Awesome. Okay. 1-800, the letter A and the word family. And of course, you can go to focusonthefamily.com to avail yourself of all the articles, books, resources, broadcasts, everything else that if you do a search may address some of your questions as well. So thank you, Dr. Jared.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be with you, Lisa.
Okay, folks, that is it for this week's show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org so we can answer your question, or maybe you just want to share, you know, your own story. We can certainly, we would love to hear that from you as well. So make sure you stay in touch with us. We love it when that happens. If you have any plans to be visiting Colorado Springs in the future, pop by our offices. And until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.